Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories we're covering today, Friday, December 14th, 2018. A top South Sudanese official admits illegal checkpoints are still a big problem.
So I want to urge our security forces that they must remove these roadblocks and these unnecessary checkpoints. The president is very clear that he made several orders that these checkpoints must be removed.
And the UNMISS chief says its mission is compromised by ongoing fighting in parts of South Sudan.
The biggest challenge has been to work as best we can to try and to alleviate, to prevent as much as possible those and protect people in South Sudan.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. And we have some breaking news for you this morning. The U.S. Treasury Department today added three more individuals to its sanctions list for, quote, being leaders of entities whose actions have the purpose or effect of expanding or extending the conflict in South Sudan, end quote. In a press release today, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, also known as OFAC, named retired Israeli Major General Israel Ziv, wealthy South Sudanese businessman Obak William Olawo, and South Sudanese Gregory Vasili, who reportedly has direct ties to President Salva Kiir, for actions that have undermined peace, stability, and security in South Sudan. Treasury is targeting individuals who have provided soldiers, armored vehicles, and weapons used to fuel the conflict in the country, said Sigal Mandelker, the undersecretary of the Treasury for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. Gregory Vasili, also known as Adul Gregory Deng Kwok, who OFAC says facilitated the transportation of South Sudanese soldiers and tanks to and from locations in South Sudan, and says he has been involved in brokering deals for the sale of military equipment to the government of South Sudan. Olawo Obak William, also known as Ola Ubak William, routinely imported standard and armored vehicles for the government of South Sudan, according to the U.S. press release. The U.S. also says one of his entities was identified transporting soldiers, arms, and supplies in support of a government offensive. And then there is Ziv Israel, also known as Zilberstein Israel Baruch. He is identified by OFAC as a retired Israeli military commander who supplied both the government and the opposition with weapons and ammunition. Following today's announcement, the U.S. says any property or interests in property of those designated by OFAC that is within or transiting U.S. jurisdiction or the possession or control of a U.S. person must be blocked and reported to OFAC. Well, Brian Adeba is Deputy Director of Policy for the U.S.-based Enough Project, and he joins us today. Thank you for being here to talk to us today about these new sanctions announced by the U.S. government. Brian, can you fill us in on who these three individuals are, beginning with Gregory Vasili, and what he what his connections are to the government?
Well, according to the U.S. Treasury's statement, Gregory Vasili facilitated the transport of troops, recruited a militia, and this is from the press release, that was complicit in violence in while he was state governor in northern Bahar Ghazal. The others, of course, are Obach William is cited as a businessman with very close links to the government and has been instrumental in importing equipment, military equipment for the government. And then you have the Israeli general who is also cited as being complicit in facilitating the government's access to military resources.
And how do you explain that third person, Israel Ziv, playing, it seems like he was playing both sides of the conflict, is that right?
Well, according to the statement here, he is supporting or facilitated access to government resources. Now, in explaining this role, you need to be aware that access to resources outside the country needs third parties, and these third parties come in the likes of the Israeli general. It comes in the likes of foreign companies that facilitate this, and therefore the action by the United States here, which is what we call network sanctions, is very crucial to sort of stymieing the advent of these wars. You know, holding the perpetrators of these conflict accountable for their actions. And it's not just enough to go after individuals. It's important to go after the network that is behind individuals that perpetuate conflict. For instance, you have to go at individuals, but you also have to go at the companies that they own that link them to the global financial system. And you also have to look at the facilitators in the international system, like the Israeli general here.
So on a day-to-day basis, I think many people are wondering, will this really hurt these three men? I mean, what effect will the new sanctions have on these three? If they are not U.S. citizens, they don't live here in the U.S., what kind of effect is it going to have?
Well, it's, the United States is one of the most significant players in the financial sector globally. Its links are just extensive. And so the use of the U.S. dollar, for instance, gives the U.S. A lot of jurisdiction. So this is where these entities that have been sanctioned are likely to be affected. Their access to the U.S. dollar, their access to the global markets, the access of their companies to spare parts that have any link in their production to the U.S. So these are the measures that may affect them in the long term.
Have we heard anything at all from the government yet in response to this?
The statement came out at around 10:30. That would be quite late in South Sudan, and therefore offices would have closed. But you may expect a reaction probably tomorrow.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's Brian Adeba with the Washington-based Enough Project. Thanks for being here today.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. The South Sudan Minister for Humanitarian Affairs has called on government security agencies to remove checkpoints which block aid agencies' access to the needy and hamper their work across the country. Aid agencies are appealing for $1.5 billion to provide assistance to millions of people next year. Waki Simon Wudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Speaking at an event launching South Sudan's Humanitarian Response Plan for 2019, Humanitarian Affairs Minister Hassan Marnuot said illegal roadblocks erected by government security agents used to extort money from aid agencies remains one of the biggest obstacles to aid agencies working in South Sudan.
So I want to urge our security forces that they must remove these roadblocks and these unnecessary checkpoints. The president is very clear, and I want to assure you here that the president is on your side and is our side, that he made several orders that these checkpoints must be removed.
On several occasions, President Salva Kiir has ordered security agencies to allow aid workers unfettered access to all parts of the country. Despite those orders and the signing of the revitalized peace agreement 3 months ago, aid agencies say they continue to face obstacles as they try to deliver assistance to South Sudan's most vulnerable. Alan Nadao, the UN Chief Humanitarian Coordinator in South Sudan, says the safety of aid workers and a lack of access to the people in need is a huge problem.
We have a year in which unfortunately, we had many more humanitarian aid workers who had lost their lives in the process of 2018. We also had a situation in 2018 where there were a situation where people were being detained by armed forces as they're trying to provide humanitarian assistance in some part of the country.
Nuot acknowledges there are still at least 80 illegal roadblocks between Juba and Bentiu. He says the Kiir administration is trying to close all illegal checkpoints. Minister Nuot warns governors and local authorities against taking unilateral decisions that obstruct the work of the aid agencies.
If it is an issue of security, you report to the Minister of Interior or the security organs, it will be brought to our attention, the Minister of Humanitarian or the RRC, and then we have to look at it and deal with that particular organization. If it amounts to that this person to be removed from the location in the field, we discuss it with their head offices here in Juba. It's not the governor to send away these people.
Nuot says now that the former warring parties are observing a permanent ceasefire and implementing the peace deal, challenges of access should end by next year. He says humanitarian needs are expected to increase next year as thousands of displaced people return to their homes from IDP camps or neighboring countries, and is encouraging aid agencies to continue providing food, health care, and shelter.
We need food. We need also medicine, because, you know, all these, they go together. And indeed, with the return, we need shelter for people who are actually coming, because a lot of people will be moving either from the towns, going to the villages and all. They will need shelter where actually they can stay. They will need definitely water, boreholes.
Aid agencies estimated that more than 7 million people will be in need of aid in South Sudan in 2019. They say while the intensity of the conflict has reduced, people will continue to experience the impacts of the conflict throughout next year, with a possible escalation of hunger and malnutrition. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The UN mission in South Sudan says a series of special projects funded by the mission has improved the lives of people across the country. David Shearer, the UN chief in South Sudan of UNMISS, says it's had a difficult time implementing its new mandate due to increased violence across the country. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
UNMISS Chief David Shearer on Tuesday released a report entitled The People's Project, which describes UNMISS' new mandate of civilian protection amid increasing threats and challenges, and how the mission provided South Sudanese access to basic services despite those challenges. Sierra says while protecting civilians from imminent threats, UNMISS was able to fund more than 100 projects to the tune of $7.5 million for clean drinking water, education, health care, and building safe houses for vulnerable women.
But the projects include the drilling of dozens of water boreholes so that communities have access to clean water. We've rehabilitated hospitals and schools so families can stay healthy and children can get education. Safe houses for vulnerable women exposed to domestic and sexual violence. Building police stations and courthouses to strengthen the justice system and hold perpetrators of violence to account. And supporting new infrastructure like fish markets and youth sports complexes to encourage economic development and peace-building initiatives.
Dr. Maker Isaac works at Juba Teaching Hospital, one of the institutions which benefits from the UN projects. Isaac says solar-powered lights provided by UNMISS has helped nurses and doctors work at night on patients.
This Queen Infact project, which was done in the hospital, I think it was last April, made a lot of changes in the hospital, especially at night. You know, we have light in all the dark corners in the hospital. Previously, it was very difficult for our nurses to move at night, especially if we don't have electricity. But now, if we don't have light, we still work at night.
Anna Martin, a nurse at Juba Teaching Hospital, says the UN intervention has been very helpful to medical workers like herself.
It was really difficult, you know, to work without light. And sometimes, like at night, you have a lot of patients. In outpatient, we are receiving a lot of patients. So it's really difficult. I remember there is a time we here in the administration, we arranged something like buying a torch. Huh? Each ward has a torch. But sometimes this torch cannot be there. So the nurse who is working, huh? At the duty, he has to find if he have a phone, a smartphone, or either any phone who have light, then he can use that phone.
But Maker says the hospital has no garbage collection facilities and the mortuary at the hospital has no capability for preserving bodies. Another project funded by UNMISS is building safe houses for vulnerable women. Shara says UNMISS constructed a safe house for women suffering from domestic violence in Torit, where the women can receive counseling and support. But Sierra says it has been difficult to implement the UNMISS mandate, as South Sudan's conflict created multiple challenges and caused new displacements.
I mean, I guess our biggest challenge has been to work as best we can to try and to alleviate, to prevent as much as possible those and protect people in South Sudan. That's been our biggest challenge over the last few years. I think going forward is the big challenge in the months to come is the fact that we have a peace process which is starting to develop,
And if we are able to get in behind it and give it the support that it needs and ensure that the parties to the conflict are determined and can continue to do what they are doing.
Sierra says the number of internally displaced people who have been sheltering in ICE protection sites in Juba, Wau, Malakal, Bentiu and Bor has fallen significantly and many are now returning home. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
A Juba-based think tank says the South Sudan government is failing to manage the country's oil sector in a transparent manner as required by law. The Sud Institute presented a preliminary report on environmental management and transparency on South Sudan's oil sector this week. Winnie Serino has the story for VOA from Juba.
Sud Institute policy analyst Zakaria Ding says the government is not publishing as much information about the country's oil production as it did in 2016.
Places where this information was supposed to be made public, which is looking at the websites of both the Ministry of Finance and the Ministry of Petroleum, and also looking at the reporting by the media organizations about this. And what we have found is that there is a drop with respect to the publication of the information that is needed from 42 to 26.
Ding says both the Petroleum Revenue Management Act 2013 and the Public Financial Management and Accountability Act 2011 stipulate how the oil sector should be managed and how the resources should be generated. He says the two laws also require the government to make available to the public information about the exploitation of resources, but that's not being done. Ding says the government should obey the law to stop corruption by government officials.
The government should publish the information as the laws require. That is what is needed, because if there is no transparency and accountability with respect to how the oil revenues are being managed, there are a lot of issues that will surface, and it is simply not in the interest of the country.
Awo Daniel Chuang, Director General for Petroleum Authority at the Petroleum Ministry, admits the ministry's website is not working but says his staff plans to activate the website by January. He says the ministry publishes journals on oil information every year and releases the publications to institutions and people who require the information. Chuang accuses reporters and researchers of releasing incorrect information about the country's petroleum ministry.
Usually it will be the journalists, the media houses, the research centers who are supposed to come and collect information and then display them to the community, or probably the people of South Sudan, because our role is not to display. What we do, we give access to anyone who is going to display on our behalf, because we don't do that.
Agustino Ting Mayai, another policy analyst and director of research at the Sud Institute, says only a few people benefit from South Sudan's oil sector. He says the government should train more South Sudanese in oil exploration and production and pay them a fair wage.
80% of the workforce is South Sudanese. However, the incentives remain fairly low for the South Sudanese. Give an example that I presented. An expert makes two times what the South Sudanese makes hourly.
Mayai says the Petroleum Act contains a lot of blanket statements and stipulations which must be clarified.
The policy needs to be quite specific in identifying what the South Sudanese need in terms of skills, and also providing plateaus on benefits. How much should a South Sudanese make versus what an expert makes? That is not there right now. And for how long can we have experts running our oil industry? That also needs to be defined, because transition is essential.
Chuang says it's true that only a few South Sudanese are experienced in the oil and gas industry. He says ministry staff hope to pair South Sudanese employees with oil experts working in South Sudan. He says state-owned Nile Petroleum Corporation has a responsibility to train and build the capacity of the South Sudanese in the oil and gas industry.
You have experience in oil and gas, then you can work anywhere, not only in South Sudan. Even for us, we want South Sudan to be trained, their skills to be developed, so that they even compete with the experts.
Sud Institute analysts say the government and the oil companies should work together to protect the environment of oil-producing areas and be transparent about where the revenue from oil sector is going, as South Sudan's leaders embark on implementing the revitalized peace agreement. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. People in the diaspora talk openly about the conflict back home. Find out more when we return.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the best advice you have ever gotten?
I got an advice from my mom. She encouraged me to work hard. That she told me, and a very successful woman is a very hardworking woman.
The great one I can remember is the one my father gave to me to study hard. Actually, he was on his, I can say, maybe a deathbed. He was so ill. He had stroke and he was so helpless. He couldn't do anything for me. That was the last day I even saw him. He was like, my son, study hard.
Is from my father. He has always told me that I shouldn't be afraid to learn new things and to take up new challenges, because he said that you're only afraid to take up new challenges when you haven't tried it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The U.S. Institute of Peace organized a South Sudan diaspora dialogue recently where members of the diaspora from across the U.S. spoke honestly about touchy subjects like tribalism and the causes of the conflict in their country. On the eve of the five-year anniversary of the conflict in South Sudan, Program Director David Achuak says an open dialogue is critical as the country pursues implementing the new peace deal.
So you have 10 South Sudanese that has been trained for four consecutive days here in Washington on information on how to conduct community dialogue. And then phase two is now these facilitators that has been trained are now going to go out across the, you know, the continental United States, and we will be conducting series of community dialogues among South Sudanese. In many of the other dialogues that has been done, including the quote-unquote dialogue in South Sudan now, you have individuals that are not well-prepared, that are not trained, attempting to conduct dialogues, and that is by itself is a failure. So this dialogue is going to solicit community-based alternative framework for conflict mitigation, resolution, and intercommunal healing. We want to make sure we create a conducive environment in the diaspora to accept the implementation of the peace agreement. And to do that, folks in the diaspora must come together as community, as South Sudanese, and forgive each other for what happened and try to find a way to work together.
And David, you just wrapped up training, as I understand. I was surprised to learn that there were psychologists on site of the training. Why is it important to have professionals in the psychology field present at the training?
The most important, the reason of having the psychologists there is that if the problem that we are facing in South Sudan date back to the previous civil war between Sudan and South Sudan. And none of us have ever had the opportunity to meet with psychologists and professionals to talk through your own individual trauma. The core team facilitators of 10 people must by themselves go through the filter, you know, the filtering process. So we sat down individually and as a group and talked and spoke to the psychologists, because we wanted to admit ourselves as the dialogue facilitators that none of us is immune to the trauma.
And this is all happening just right ahead of the anniversary of the conflict.
Exactly. So as you know, that the first dialogue will take place in January, but on the eve of the anniversary of December 15, the team is ready to go, but because of other, you know, administrative compromises that we have to go through, we delayed the kickoff of the dialogue until January.
You mentioned previously that South Sudan has its own national dialogue going on. Are there any plans with this USIP-funded event to take what you're doing into South Sudan to facilitate a dialogue there as well?
Well, it will be up to the South Sudanese leaders in the country and both outside the country to decide whether they want to benefit from the skills and resources that we have. But the goal here is to make sure that the diaspora do not fuel or contribute to confusing, inflammatory, and divisive language on social media or otherwise, you know, to the, what is going on in South Sudan.
That is David Achuak, Program Director of the South Sudan Diaspora Dialogue, speaking to Ayen Deng Bior from Alexandria, Virginia. And this year marks the 25th anniversary of the National Guard's State Partnership Program, where U.S. states are matched with nations across the globe to grow their military and government capabilities. 81 nations are partnered with the troops, many of which are in Africa. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb spoke with Command Sergeant Major Christopher Kepner, Senior Enlisted Advisor of the National Guard, about the program's goals.
Well, I'll tell you, the State Partnership Program, we have 13 nations partnering with 11 states. We partner now to do different things like medical training. We also do disaster relief partnerships, building the non-commissioned officer corps, poaching, interdiction. Really, whatever a nation might need, we try to bring that capability and tailor what they're looking for to help them build that security within their own nation.
Counter-poaching, what benefit does that bring to the countries?
Oh, well, when you have that poaching that goes on inside of those countries, it affects the economy. It's illegal activity. It's also can be a sign to the nation that there's not the rule of law. And so those kinds of things are very, very important to help that nation provide security within its own borders.
Why should Africans not be nervous about these partnerships?
Because these partnerships are really designed to help them bring what they need to help them have security within their individual countries. So it's really not an American solution coming in to fix all of their problems. It's about augmenting these nations to help them become stronger.
You look at Africa Command's website and you look at the number of activities going on in Africa, and there seems to be more and more every year.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about why that is, why Africa is gaining importance with the United States.
Africa is a very, very important continent. And really, if you look at our national defense strategy, you know, one of our main lines of effort is to strengthen partnerships and allies. And that fits right in with the continent of Africa and those nations on the continent of Africa to help them be security providers throughout the world and not security consumers.
How does a hurricane in one state affect its ability to get out and work these partnerships?
Yeah. So I have to tell you, and so not only with hurricanes, keep in mind for the last 15 years of war, we have been globally deployed supporting that fight as well. But to get to your question about how do we do that, we're 450,000 strong with Army and Air National Guardsmen. And when you have a state partnership, you just don't have access to that state. You have access to the entire capability of the National Guard.
Do we still have a light footprint in Africa, or have we increased our footprint?
So I'll tell you this, from a state partnership program perspective and a National Guard perspective, we are increasing our footprint from the perspective of we have two more countries right now that are going through the process, not approved yet, but are going through the process to see if we are going to have partnerships with them. So the state partnership program, I can say confidently, is growing in the continent of Africa.
And the two states that would be partnered with those countries? I know you can't name the countries, but what two states are looking at being added on?
Can't name those either because it's still going through the staffing process.
Okay, fair enough, sir. And then my final would be, because of this increased footprint, does any of that have to do with the counterterror fight?
I think to say that it has to do with the counterterror fight is too narrow, if that makes sense to you. There's a broad spectrum of capabilities that we bring to, like I said, to include disaster relief, to include partnering for non-commissioned officer education, to include training and crosstalk, and like I said, mutual relationships. I think to say that the counterterrorism piece is too narrow to say that's why we're increasing the footprint. It's much, much broader than that.
That's Command Sergeant Major Christopher Kepner, the Senior Enlisted Advisor of the National Guard, speaking with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
Kepler 45 2B.
That's our show. I'm Carol Van Damme. Thanks for joining us here at South Sudan in Focus on VOA, and have a great weekend. We leave you with the song Selfie by Koffi Olomide.
Ah, Jésus Seigneur.
C'est bien.
Ahmed Bakayoko, l'homme du peuple.
Amigo! Chuma, amigo!
Mila lobisto pe.
Allez, ta poésie.
Jean-François Ndenge.
Ndenge lobisto pe.
C'est bon.
Allez, ta poésie.